Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. David Gross and I are old friends. We're both MacArthur Fellows. So we have talked about stuff over the years. And if I don't get a chance to see him, please bring him my warm hellos. I'm going to talk about work that, as Lewis suggested, started a long time ago. It started about 35 years ago or 37 years ago. And we're still getting new data on it. But let me tell you what the two main problems are. I've been forewarned that the audience is pretty biologically sophisticated, but I'm still going to say things as if you didn't know them, just so that we're sure that we're on common territory. The first is the problem of cell differentiation. I just want to tell you what it is. We all started as fertilized eggs, as a zygote, which is a single cell type. That cell divides about 50 times, making 2 to the 50th cells, and the cells become different from one another, so that you have liver cells and kidney cells and spleen cells and nerve cells and muscle cells and so on. So the problem of cell differentiation is, how do all of these cells with the same set of genes in them, with some minor exceptions in the immune system, become different from one another? And the fact that they have the same set of genes in them can be shown by a really remarkable experiment that was done many years ago. You can take any single cell of a carrot and regenerate an entire carrot. So all of the cells have all the information needed to make a carrot, but there's still yellow cells and green cells and a carrot. That's the limits of my knowledge of botany. Now, you all know that DNA contains genes, and that genes are transcribed into RNA, and that RNA is then translated into proteins. I'm saying that because I'm sure you all know it, but just to be on the common turf, okay? And Jacob and Monod, two French microbiologists, in the 60s, discovered something terribly important. They discovered that one gene could make a protein that would bind to a DNA region near another gene and regulate whether the other gene was transcribed and subsequently translated. So they remark in a paper in 1963 that here's an idea about how cell differentiation might happen. Imagine you have two genes, A and B, that turn one another off. It's called to repress. So that little circuit has the possibilities of two steady states, A on, B off, and A off, B on. And so they say, you see, the same genome can have two different patterns of gene expression, and that could control differentiation. So everybody has thought that they were fundamentally right. And the basic idea then is that cell types are different from one another because different patterns of genes are expressed in them. So for example, a white cell makes antibody molecules, hemoglobin is made by red cells, actin and myosin that form the muscle filaments are made specially by muscle cells. Of course, most cells make actin and myosin, but the crystalline cells in your lens are made, the crystalline proteins are made. So different cell types make different specific patterns of genes, active or inactive. Now, when I started all of this a long time ago, I invented something called random Boolean networks. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to ask the following question, which is still a preeminent question to which we do not know the answer. One needs to think of the cell and the organism as containing some rich network of genes turning one another on and off somehow. And I'm going to show you some data in a moment on the board. And the question is, is that network one that is very specially constructed by evolution acting over 3.8 billion years? Namely, is it a very specific, special machine? Or are there broad classes of networks that have the kind of dynamical order that you need to control development from the fertilized egg? And has selection been an opportunist and chosen useful networks from among a class, all of which have useful properties? So I set out to find out whether or not there were broad classes of networks, and you physicists would use the term generic behavior. I sought to find out whether or not there were networks that had as their generic properties richly ordered behaviors. Not knowing differential equations at the time, I idealized a gene as if it were just on or off. So I idealized it as a binary variable. And I began making networks in which there were n genes. The genes were each connected to k other genes as inputs. And I built random Boolean networks because I wanted to sample at random from the ensemble of all possible networks with n genes and k inputs per gene. So I just made random networks where you assigned at random the k inputs to each gene, and you assigned at random to each gene the Boolean function that it realized. And then I sought to study the generic behavior of networks as a function of n and k. So it's sort of like spin classes, where you ask as a function of the number of spins in the network and something about the coupling constants and the number of spins that any spin is coupled to, for example, what you can say about the generic behavior of the potential function on the network. Yes?
So generally speaking, how do you want k to scale?
Well, what I did was let k be constant, okay? And of course, k isn't constant. I'll actually show you what data, I mean, one had no data 35 years ago, okay, at all, on all of this. In fact, we're just beginning to get the data now. Okay, let me begin by, let's see, I don't have an overhead for this. Can we lift the screen for a second? I just want to draw something. Thanks, and I'll know how to put it down. That's enough. Okay, it just goes up and toggles up and down, I assume. Okay, so let me tell you what's now known, as far as I know, and Kim was just telling me that there's maybe some other data as well, about the regulatory network in yeast. There's a paper in Science in October 25th by a very large number of people, the last of whom is a guy named Richard Young, who's at the Whitehead Institute. And what they did is they cloned a molecular bump from a particular protein into, so now I have to use a technical phrase, transcription factors. So the genes that regulate other genes, the proteins, gene A makes a protein that regulates gene B. The protein that does that regulating is either called a transcription factor, or sometimes it's called a trans factor, because it acts in trans, it acts at a distance. And the little sites next to a gene that the trans factor binds to are called CIS, cis sites, meaning nearby sites, which includes promoters and enhancers and a whole bunch of other kinds of structural elements. What Young and his colleagues did was to mark with a molecular bump by cloning it into it, each of about 140 or so transcription factors. Out of that, they got 106 transcription factors that still worked okay. Apparently, they sort of screwed up some of the transcription factors by the molecular bumps. And then they used what are called monoclonal antibodies to that molecular bump to find out where the transcription factor bound. Okay? So they have the best data right now that I know of on actual networks. And here's what they found out. Everybody see that all right? They found a distribution of numbers of inputs that looks kind of like this. So that most genes have one input. Notice that this is a logarithmic scale. Then some genes have two inputs, some have three inputs, some have four inputs, some have five inputs, and it's a scooped distribution like that. Yes? A molecular bump is technically it's called an epitope. It's a piece of a, for example, protein that makes a fold or a loop, and that feature can be recognized by an antibody molecule. Yeah, it's just a way of marking the transcription factor. It was just so that they could, it was just a way of putting a little molecular marker on the transcription factor so they could follow where it bound. They could actually find it later. Yes?
Actually, most genes have zero inputs in this experiment. It depends on the threshold somewhat, but something like one third of the genes doesn't have a single transcription factor.
Oh, they don't show that in their graph. So is that true if you tune your threshold?
Yes, of course, they studied it only under one condition, so it's to be expected that some transcription factors won't bind at all.
That may be true. What?
What fraction of transcription factors was studied?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. My guess is there's probably maybe 250 or something like that in yeast, but that's just a guess. Yes?
So I guess the other thing that worries me in the methodology is you said that about half of them or a third of them or whatever didn't bind at all after this modification was made. It could very well be that that disadvantage of binding is selected and hence the fanning as represented by that graph could be totally wrong. Because maybe some of these guys that did bind somewhere and therefore we think have not been affected, in fact, have been affected in a partial way and don't bind to a lot of places where they should.
I'm not quite understanding your comment.
Okay, so I thought you said that when they did this, they added this bump or whatever.
Yes.
A lot of them actually didn't bind to anything.
Yes.
And they were disregarded.
Right.
Okay. So the ones that did bind to something.
Yes.
How do we know that they bound to everything that they would have bound to?
We don't.
Would have been made.
We don't.
So this graph
could be wrong. That's true. That's a fair comment. The other thing that they found, two other things that I want to tell you about before I launch into what is in effect my own talk. No, I'm saying, you've got it backwards, Lewis. This is the number of transcription factors that bind to a gene. It's the number of inputs per gene.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. The inputs per gene.
Yeah. The outputs per gene.
Sorry.
Yeah. The outputs per gene looks like this, okay, in which the average is something like 32. So they're looking at about 106 or so transcription factors, and they're looking at about 2,500 structural genes. A structural gene is something that makes a protein. And that means the following. It means that most genes are regulated but not regulating. Okay, they're hanging off of the regulatory structure. And it is what we're calling Medusa networks. So there's a kind of a head of genes that are regulating one another, and hanging off of it are some sort of large number of genes that are regulated but do not themselves regulate, at least directly in terms of transcription. The last thing that I want to say is that when you look at this network right here, the transcription factors regulate one another. And the data shows the following, that, of course, they're missing transcription factors, but the data that we have so far says the following. There's 106 transcription factors that they studied, and they drew arrows in their figure that shows which transcription factors regulate which transcription factors, including transcription factors that regulate themselves, of which there are 10. And there are about 104, in fact, there are 104 such arrows. And that says that the connectivity of the Medusa head is low. I mean, that's a connectivity on average about 1. And so it's less than what I'm going to talk about, which is K2. But I will show you what K1 random networks do as well. Okay, so that's the best data that we've got so far. Now, what I'm going to do is, with all of that preamble, launch into the main body of my talk. So what I want to do is show you next something about transcription control rules. And this is the very system that Jacob and Minot worked on the top, right? Oh, I'm missing a slide. That's unfortunate. I've lost the slide. So I'll draw it. Thank God for blackboards. Okay, so this is in the bacterium E. coli, and it was the first transcription unit discovered. It was called the lactose operon, and they're called operons in bacteria. Is that written large enough that everybody can read it? I'll do it. Now, is that okay? Thank you. What did you just do? Oh, okay. He threw the light switch. Okay. So there are three structural genes, beta-galactosidase, a permease, and something that I don't know. And next to it are a promoter and an operator. An operator is a site that allows a gene to be repressed, or in general, it controls the regulation of a gene. Now, the promoter is bound by four factors. I won't write down what they are. Well, let's just call them A, B, C, and D. It turns out that it's the core of the transcription enzyme, a sigma factor that completes it, cyclic AMP and cyclic AMP binding protein. But I'm not going to write them down because there's not enough space. The operator is bound by a molecule called repressor. When the repressor is present, and the repressor is bound to the operator, even if the promoter has all four factors binding to it, you cannot get transcription downstream of the structural genes. So the gene is said to be repressed. But if lactose, or it's actually a metabolic breakdown product of lactose called allolactose, comes into the cell, the lactose binds to the repressor, literally changes the shape of the repressor, changes its conformation, and the repressor falls off the operator and allows transcription to happen. So from the point of view of the bacterium, this is a bright idea because the cell doesn't need to, I need to tell you that this thing, beta-galactosidase is used to metabolize lactose. So what this says is that the cell doesn't bother to make the enzyme that metabolizes lactose unless lactose is present, and then lactose de-represses the operator, and you make beta-galactosidase and can metabolize lactose. And that's the biological functional importance of the lactose operon. You don't waste energy making an enzyme when there's nothing around for it to work on. Yes? Yeah, because you make a lot of the enzyme and the repressor is present in extremely low concentration. It's about 1 per cell or 2 per cell, which makes you worry about whether or not you can use differential equations to describe this because the numbers are so small. Okay, now, what I just told you in words, if you will allow me to idealize a gene as on or off, which is kind of crudely true, but it's not really true. I mean, genes really show continuous variations in the levels of their inputs. And I need to tell you that most of what I'm going to show you today about Boolean networks has been extended to a family of sort of quasi-continuous functions, piecewise linear functions by Leon Glass, and one finds grossly the same things. So what I'm going to tell you is, by and large, robust to the idealization for Boolean variables. And I'll show you the difference between that and continuous functions when we get to it. So here's repressor and here's lactose. And that's the four possible states of their being present or absent. And what I've just told you is the following. If repressor is present and there's no lactose, the operator is bound. So the operator is repressed. If neither of them is around, then of course the operator is free, which I'll symbolize by a zero. If lactose alone is present, the operator is free. And if they're both present, the repressor binds to the operator and pulls it off. So that's the Boolean function. It's the not if Boolean function. Yes?
That in fact in real life things are not on what does that mean from a mechanistic point of view? Does that have to do with the fact that the repressor binds
all
sort of stochastic
processes? Yeah. Exactly.
Just that, the fact that it might
Yeah, that's right. The repressor well, first of all, there are promoters. A gene may have more than one promoter. And promoters have different efficiencies. That is to say, if you bind one promoter, you get a lot of transcription. If you bind another promoter, you don't get very much transcription. Yeah, right, exactly. Right, that's exactly fair. Okay, now I just want to tell you that the Boolean function for the promoter, I can't write it down, has four inputs, and all four factors have to be present for the promoter to work. If any one of them is missing, then the promoter does not work, okay? So that's the Boolean AND function on four inputs. So then the first conclusion to draw is, given the Boolean idealization, the rule that controls genes differ from gene to gene to gene to gene. So we can't just walk in and do a standard statistical mechanics where the rule for all the genes are the same as one another. Okay, now I want to next define two parameters that characterize Boolean functions. The first I'm going to call canalizing. And the second I'm going to call P. Notice it in this Boolean function. It has a very interesting property. The property is that if repressor is absent, the operator is free, regardless of what lactose is doing. Did everybody see that? Sort of proof by inspection. Okay. So I'm going to call a Boolean function that has the property there's at least one input that has at least one value that guarantees what the regulated locus does. I'm going to call that canalizing. So this is a canalizing Boolean function. And this is a canalizing input. Because if it's off, that guarantees that the operator is free. If lactose is present, that also guarantees that the operator is free. So there are two canalizing inputs to this Boolean function. Everybody see it? Okay. Let me show you a non-canalizing function, exclusive OR. If you look at this function, then in order to know what the operator is going to do, if I know that lactose is absent, the operator could be bound, free or bound, depending upon what lactose is doing. And if the repressor is present, it could be bound or free, depending upon what lactose is doing. And vice versa for lactose, okay? So there are non-canalizing functions and canalizing functions. And the easiest way to summarize canalizing functions is, if you know the value of the canalizing input, that's the only thing you got to look at to figure out what you ought to do. For non-canalizing functions, you've got to look at more than one input to figure out what to do. Okay, now the other thing is P. Notice that there are three zeros and one one in this function column. There could be anything from all zeros to all ones coming down here. Take the dominant value, the one that comes up most often, and just write down the fraction of time it comes up in the four places that it can come up, and that's what P is. So P is equal to 3/4. Or 75%, sort of obviously. Even a biologist can do that division. So P varies between 0.5 and 1. So Boolean functions can be characterized by P, another parameter that characterizes them. And it's going to turn out that both of these factors are important for the behavior of networks. Okay, now I'm going to make a model genetic net. And I guess the overarching thing that I want to say to you as physicists is that this class of random Boolean networks, or biased random Boolean networks, is extraordinarily rich and a very worthwhile object to study. And in fact, there's now a lot of physicists who've looked at it, and some mathematicians are finally starting to look at it 35 years later. And I'm glad that that's true. And they show astonishing behaviors. The main thing that I'm going to want to tell you is that there is, well, I'll tell you instead of telling you ahead of time what I'm going to tell you. Let's make one. Here are three genes, 1, 2, and 3, and each gene in this little network receives inputs from the other two. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to assign to each gene a Boolean function on its inputs. So 1 is controlled by 2 and 3, and here are the possible states of 2 and 3, and here's the Boolean function for 1. And there's a little clock in these networks, I should have told you. These are synchronous switching networks. A little clock goes tick. All of the genes are going to look at the values of their inputs and then look up the rules and see what they ought to go do and go do their next thing. The behavior of asynchronous networks are importantly different, and I'll tell you what's known about that, which is not a lot. Okay, so anyway, the Boolean function for this is AND, like for the promoter. The Boolean function for 2, which looks at 1 and 3, is 0, 1, 1, 1, which means if input 3 is on, if input 1 is on, or both of them are on, then the Boolean function's on. And the rule for 3 is also OR. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down all the possible combinations of values of the three genes from 0, 0, 0 at time t to 1, 1, 1. So since there are n genes, there are 2 to the n combinations of their values. And since n is 3, there's 8 possible states of the network. So every one of these things is a state of the network. So this is the state space of the little network. Here I write down the Boolean functions written this way. So 1 looks at 2 and 3 and realizes the AND function, and you can see it goes 0, 0, 0, 1 for 2 and 3. Then 2 and 3 repeat their pattern so that 1 can be 0 and 1, and so the pattern repeats down here. And this is the Boolean functions for the other two variables. Everybody got what I've done? Now the fun of this, of course, is to read it from left to right, because you've integrated the equations then. You say that the state 0, 0, 0 at time t goes to the state 0, 0, 0 at time t plus 1. And the state 0, 0, 1 goes to the state 0, 1, 0 at the next time moment. And so that's shown here. I don't know why this is smaller than this, but it almost embarrasses me, but there it is. So here's 0, 0, 0 going to itself. So wait a second, what just happened? Okay, it's a little steady state. So let's think for a moment about what such a network has to do. Hi, David. It's good to see you. There's a finite number of states. The system's in a state. A moment later, it's in a state. A moment later, it's in a state. Since there's a finite number of states, eventually it has to hit a state it's been in before. Then the system's deterministic, so it's going to go around a recurrent orbit in state space called a state cycle. So that's what just happened here. Now notice that 0, 0, 1 goes to 0, 1, 0, and 0, 1, 0 goes to 0, 0, 1, and that's this little state cycle length 2. 1, 1, 1 goes to itself, and the rest of the states flow into it along transients, and so that's the third state cycle. So the generic behaviors of these networks, and in fact of many nonlinear dynamical systems, are they have multiple basins of attraction. A basin of attraction is a state cycle and all the states that flow onto it, so that's a basin of attraction. This is a basin of attraction, doesn't have any transients on it, and so is that. Is fake.
Yeah.
Right. One wants to ask what? Huh? Yes, it does matter.
Yes, I guess it
yeah. And so I'll tell you a little bit about what asynchronous networks do. Then I'll tell you about what piecewise linear networks do. Yeah, it is fake. Okay. It's an idealization, but allows us to get started. Okay. Now the question. Here's a question that no one knows the answer to, which is the following. We know that cell types are somehow patterns of gene expression, and cells are different because they have different patterns of gene expression. But if you have, let's ask, how many genes are there in a human? And it used to be thought that there was 100,000 genes in a human. Then the Human Genome Project came through and it was thought that there was something like 30,000 genes. And now that number's gone up to 40,000 to 60,000. So I don't know where it's going to end up. Meanwhile, genes are alternatively spliced. I won't explain that in detail, but little pieces called exons are shuffled together in random, not random, but in a variety of ways. So one gene can make more than one protein. So the diversity of proteins might be on the order of 100,000 or so. Let's just think that there's merely 30,000 genes, and each gene can be on or off. Then how many possible patterns of gene expression are there? And the answer is obviously 2 to the 30,000th, which is whatever it is, 10 to the 10,000th or so. So it's a huge number. Now, what's the cell type? This picture suggests a natural answer, and I'm going to take that natural answer, but we don't know that it's true. The idea is that the state cycle attractors, oh, I'm sorry, I haven't defined the word attractor, but you probably all know it from dynamical systems. The system flows along transients and gets to a subset of states into which it sticks, and that's called the attractor. So there's three attractors here. The hypothesis that I made 38 years ago is that the attractors, the state cycles, are the cell types. And they're the natural thing to call your attention to be attractors, because to be cell types, because they are, if you will, the stable asymptotic behaviors of the network. If you let the system alone, it'll settle down to that and stay there. Now,
can I interrupt you again? Because you know that I don't like this idea.
Yes. I know you don't. I've known you for 37 years and you've never liked the idea, Lewis.
And what worries me is I feel that you cook the books by making the genes interact with each other, whereas the essence of cell differentiation is an end part, and it's one gene turning on two other genes, and there's no difference.
Well, I don't know that we know that.
I claim we do.
Okay, well, can we come? We'll come back and argue about it later. We know that genes regulate one another, Lewis. Okay.
Not, sorry. The
that's
essence of development as you go forwards.
No, you do go forwards, and well, and
yeah.
Well, the going forward part. Okay, I'll come to later. Okay, I think that we do in fact go forward. Anyway, here's a little network. So now, if these are cell types, the next thing I want to show you is the notion of the stability of a cell type. Yes?
I guess I just want to suggest a refinement in the cell type. It retains its type even though it responds to, say, changes in the environment, which would require changes in gene expression. So you're suggesting that maybe only a subset of the genes in the cell, which is determining its type, are in the cell?
Yeah, or there may be. And I'm going to ask the people slow down questions a little bit, because I've got a lot to get through and I've taken a long time. And this isn't a criticism of you, obviously. It may be that cell types modulate through, so it's not a single attractor, but it's sort of a small region in state space that corresponds to a cell type. Now the answer is that we don't know if a cell type's an attractor. We're just at the point where we can ask that kind of question, and I'll show you, because everything I'm going to tell you today is now open to experimental tests using contemporary techniques. We can find out whether or not that's true, and I want to get to it. But notice the following. Suppose that a hormone comes into this cell type, and it switches the first gene on transiently, so just a transient perturbation. Then a moment later, the cell type is over here, and then it flows into this state cycle. If this second gene is switched on, it jumps to here, and then it's here. And if the third one is switched on transiently, it jumps to here, then it's over here. So transient perturbations leave this cell type perturbed. It doesn't come back to where it was. So it's unstable to any perturbation. This cell type is stable to any single gene perturbation, because it'll either go there, there, or there, and then it'll come right back. So we can ask about the stability properties of these attractors, and I'll be doing that shortly, if I get that far. By the way, if you mutate the network, so I changed one of the rules, you change the state space and the state cycles in it, and I won't take you through that. Now, what I want to do is I want to show you the results of, in a way, the results of 30 years or 35 years of work. And this, in a way, to you as physicists, might well be the most exciting thing about these networks. It turns out that these networks, random Boolean networks, as a function of some simple parameters like the number of inputs per variable and biases like catalyzing functions in P, behave in only two basic ways. They either behave in an ordered regime or they behave in a chaotic regime. And there's in fact a phase transition between the ordered regime and the chaotic regime. And that there should exist an ordered regime stunned me when I discovered it 35 years ago. And I want you to get a feeling for it. So I'm going to make a movie. I'm going to put all my genes on a little square lattice, and then I'm going to glue the edges together so it's got periodic boundary conditions. And each gene has inputs from four other genes. Of course, real genetic nets don't look anything like that. And I have never done that, but some physicist friends of mine did that, and I thought, what a neat way of displaying things. And so you can sort of think of this as a local network, local connectivity network. And the same thing is true if you make a random network in terms of the wiring diagram, which is harder to see. So there's an ordered regime, and I'm going to explain it as follows. Start the network in a state, let the network continue to go through states. If a gene is turning on and off, color it green. If a gene becomes stuck off or stuck on, color it red. It stopped changing. And what you find in the ordered regime is that at first all the genes are green, then more and more of them turn red, and then finally you have a red frozen structure that percolates across the network. So it's the size of the frozen structure scales with the size of the system, and it leaves behind little green islands where the genes are twinkling on and off. So that's the ordered regime. The chaotic gene regime is just the opposite. In the chaotic regime, what you get is a green twinkling sea and little red frozen islands. And the phase transition happens as you tune the parameters of the number of inputs per gene and canalizing function ratios, or P, when, as you tune the parameters, the green sea is just breaking up into green islands. So that's the definition of the phase transition, and there's various signatures of it. Okay, now the next thing I want to tell you is that we can look at what happens if you put in perturbations to a gene. We can define an avalanche of the effects of a gene on other genes if we transiently perturb it. So Dietrich Stauffer defined a gene as damaged if its dynamical behavior is ever different than it would have been if you hadn't perturbed it. The gene isn't damaged, Lewis. It's not that it's structurally damaged. Yes? Sure. That's right. I think it is, but I hear your point. In fact, there is order in the twinkling patterns in the little green islands. I'll tell you a little bit about what the twinkling pattern looks like in the chaotic regime. I'm going to have to go fast. And can I go till 10 after? Okay. Okay. I'm going to have a hard time finishing because we've talked so much. Okay. Now, if you change the value of a gene, call a gene damaged if its dynamical behavior is ever different than it would have been, even if it goes back to normal a moment later. So I can now define an avalanche. I change the value of a gene, and I ask if any of its output descendants change their values. And what you get is a spreading avalanche of damage that's confined to within this green island. The avalanche does not propagate out through the red frozen structure. So the size of avalanches do not scale with the size of the system. They scale with the size of these little green islands. And they're small, and I'll show you the data on this. In fact, you get a power law distribution of sizes of avalanches in the ordered regime. In the chaotic regime, if you damage a gene that's in the frozen component, nothing happens. It goes back to being normal a moment later, and that's it. So you don't get an avalanche at all. Maybe one or two other genes change their behavior, but that's it. In the chaotic regime, if I change a gene in the green sea, I get a big spreading wave of avalanche that spreads out and damages a finite fraction that scales with the size of the system of the other genes. And it's 30 or 40 or 50% of the genes that change their activities. Now that would predict, if cells were in the chaotic regime, and I argued that they're in the ordered regime, that would say that if you put in a hormone or you put in some sort of funny chemical that changed the activities of a gene, usually changes of activities in thousands of other genes. And I don't think any biologist thinks of that what you're going to see. And I want to tell you that that's now testable. Do you all know about DNA chips and chip arrays? so you're all familiar with them. So we can use chip arrays now to actually analyze perturbations and the number of genes that alter their states. There's nothing that prevents us from looking at this in a straightforward way with lots of chemical perturbations or by cloning promoters upstream of genes and using controllable promoters to turn genes on and so on and look at the size of avalanches. So that's completely testable. Okay. Bernard Derrida and Yves Pommeau actually proved theorems on what they call a non-quenched Boolean networks that actually showed that if you tune K, there's a phase transition from the order regime to the chaotic regime. So it's a really nice paper in about 1985. And in honor of Bernard, I call these Derrida plots. They should be Derrida plots, but nobody in America can say Derrida. So it's Derrida. So here's the idea. Suppose I take an initial state 0, 0, 0, and the network a moment later is in the state 0, 1, 0. And I take the state 0, 0, 1, and a moment later the network's in the state 1, 0, 1. I can measure the fraction of the binary variables that are different from one another in the two initial states and call that the normalized Hamming distance, and it's 1/3. So I have an initial distance between two states, and a moment later the two states are different in all three positions. So I have at a second time moment, a moment later, dt plus 1, 3 over 3, or a distance of 1. So what one's asking here is the following. Take two initial states at different initial distances apart. Identical to one another, different in 10% of the loci, different at 50% of the loci, different at 100% of the loci. Take those two states, measure the distance between them, let the network propagate the two states forward one time moment, and then measure the distance apart.
This is like a discrete Lyapunov exponent.
It's exactly like a discrete Lyapunov exponent. That's exactly what it is. Okay? But it's as a function of the initial distance. So that's sort of an addition to the standard Lyapunov exponent. What you find is the following. If you make random Boolean networks, completely random, with two inputs per light bulb, K1 is down here. One input networks are a curve, they're somewhere around down in this region. Then you have the following properties. This is the main diagonal, where the distance apart of two successor states is the same as the distance apart of two initial states. So if you're on the main diagonal, then you're neither diverging nor converging in state space. If you're below the main diagonal, then you're converging in state space. And if you're above the main diagonal, you're diverging in state space. So for K2 and for K less than 2, but K2 happens to be the phase transition. It's tangent to the curve at low initial distances, and then falls below it. And that says that on average, everywhere in state space, states tend to be converging towards one another. That can't be true everywhere, but that's an average statement, averaged over in the state space. If k is 3 or higher, or is higher than 2, then for small initial distances, the successor states are further apart than the initial states. So, for example, if you're 20% apart here, and k is 3, then you're 25 or 30% apart a moment later. So that's the start of that big avalanche that I showed you in the chaotic regime. Okay, just the one-step time moment. Now, can we measure Derrida curves for real cells? And the only problem with doing so, I mean, the answer is yes. We can measure whether or not cells are converging in state space, because what we can do is we can take cells, use gene chip arrays to measure their pattern of gene expression, perturb the activities of some finite number of genes by chemical perturbations or by cloning in controllable promoters next to genes, and ask, following the perturbations, does the system relapse back to the pattern of gene activity that it showed before, or does it diverge away from it? And how often does it do it? It's going to do both. Oh, by the way, in this story, if cell types are attractors, then cell differentiation is precisely this kind of perturbation that gets you over the hump and into another basin of attraction, so you flow to another attractor. So So the fact is that some of the cell types, like that 0-0-0 state, are unstable to all perturbations. So you don't always converge in state space. So I want you to see from this graph both a Derrida plot, and I want you to see that as you tune K, you tune from the ordered regime to the chaotic regime, and there's a phase transition here right at K2, because as I told you, K1 is down below it. Now, it's been possible, I don't have the equation for it, but it's been possible tuning P, you'll remember the P parameter, you can tune whether the system is in the ordered regime or the chaotic regime, and you can plot the phase transition line, and I've plotted it here. So if P as a function of K is greater than this line, the system's in the ordered regime, and otherwise it's in the chaotic regime. And it's been shown analytically, and it works numerically. Well, it's just for a Boolean function, it's just there's if you've got k inputs, you've got 2 to the k possible combinations of their states. So you have a vector 2 to the k long, which is the Boolean function. Either there's more zeros or more ones, or an equal number of both. Take the dominant value, say zeros are dominant, and zero is the fraction of the time that it's on. Okay, that's P. By the way, it's turning out that there's another class of Boolean functions called post functions. And if we have some time at the end, I'll tell you about it. It's turning out that post functions may be of some interest. It's also possible to work out analytically an approximation to the phase transition for canalizing functions. So this should have canalizing written on it. And it's the fraction of the Boolean functions in a network that need to be canalizing as a function of K to be in the ordered regime or the chaotic regime. And it looks something like this. Okay, and now I want to tell you a couple more things about, boy, I'll never get done. I just want to give you the feeling for a couple more things about random Boolean networks to give you the feeling for why they're sort of magical. In the chaotic regime, the lengths of the state cyclic attractors scale exponentially in the size of the system. So in the limit when k is n and you make random Boolean functions, the state cycle attractors tend to be on the order of the square root of the number of states. So if you had a network with 200 light bulbs in it, the attractor would be 2 to the 100th, which is about 10 to the 30th. So if it took a microsecond per state transition, which is a little short for genes, because it's really on the order of minutes, it would take about 10 billion times the history of the universe to go around the attractor. So I don't want my cell types doing that. it seems extremely uncomfortable to me. The stunning thing is that in the ordered regime, if you take a random Boolean network with 2 inputs, and you have a completely scrambled network and a completely randomly assigned wiring diagram and a completely randomly assigned Boolean functions to the genes, quenched though, you assign it once and for all, the lengths of the state cycles turn out to be the square root of the number of genes. So if you take 100,000, you have 2 to the 100,000 states, and the system settles down and cycles through around 317 states. That should shock you if you haven't ever heard this before. I mean, it says that our assumptions about what you need for orderly dynamics have been just wrong, because this is a mad scrambled spaghetti diagram network and a mad scramble of logic, and yet the system localizes its behavior to 300 states out of 10 to the 30,000. Now, I used to think I knew the scaling law about the number of attractors. So as of a year ago, I would have said, as I've said for 35 years, that the number of attractors is also a square root function of the number of genes. It turns out that I was wrong because of finite sampling effects. And Karsten's 2 students have published a paper suggesting that the scaling law is linear for the number of attractors. And then Josh Sokolar and I worked on the problem last spring. And at the phase transition between order and chaos, it's looking like the number of attractors is going up even faster than linearly, but we don't know how much faster. And then as you tune into the ordered regime, as you're further and further into the ordered regime, the number of attractors goes up more and more slowly with the size of the system. And in fact, you can make it be essentially a constant if you're extremely ordered. Okay, that sets me up to tell you the empirical part of what I want to tell you. Okay. Okay, so Now the question becomes the following. Can we say anything about the number of genes, inputs per gene, and anything about whether or not there's any biases on the control rules for real genes in real organisms? And what I'm going to tell you is that real genes appear to be regulated far above chance by catalyzing functions and not by high P functions. So that's what I'm about to tell you. Okay. So the next thing that I've got to tell you mathematically is the following, that as a function of K, you can calculate the fraction of the Boolean functions that are catalyzing Boolean functions. And it reaches a maximum at 2, and then it drops off to around 40%, 43% for K3. The number of Boolean functions is 2 to the 2 to the K. So there are 256 Boolean functions of 3 inputs, there's 65,000 functions of 4 inputs, there's a few billion functions of 5 inputs, and so on. Fraction catalyzing drops to about 4% for K4, and then it's infinitesimal thereafter. So that allows us to ask a question about real regulated genes. Namely, are real regulated genes biased in their use of control rules? So this story is kind of fun, and then there's some caveats to it. My colleague Steve Harris was visiting the Santa Fe Institute a number of years ago, and I told him about catalyzation, and he said, nah, genes aren't regulated by catalyzing functions. And I said, I bet they are. And he says, I bet they're not. And I said, this is a really slick move on my part. I said, gee, Steve, you've got a good library down there at the medical school in San Antonio, and we don't have a good library at the Santa Fe Institute. Why don't you read a whole bunch of papers and see what the control rules are for genes with 3, 4, or 5 known inputs, and let's see. And he took the bait. He's put in hours and hours, and he's now read papers on about 180 regulated genes. And here's what Steve had to do. So I want to see, there are several kinds of weaknesses in the data that I'm about to present you. First of all, Steve had to read the paper and understand it correctly. Second of all, he had to do a Boolean idealization. Now, the data actually tended to look like that. For example, with input 1, the gene would be on 3%, with input 2, on 5%, and with inputs 1 and 2, be on something like 80 or 90 or 100%. Okay, so that looks like an AND function. But we have to believe his Boolean idealizations, and we have to go along with the Boolean idealization for the moment. I'm going to pause to tell you something. Leon Glass has made equations that are piecewise linear on their input. So they do this, this, and this. So they're continuous, except that the derivative isn't continuous, obviously. It's piecewise linear. I could write down the equations for you if you want to, but meanwhile I won't. Everything I've told you about an ordered regime and a chaotic regime fundamentally shows up in the continuous networks. There's the same phase transition if you vary P, there's the same phase transition if you vary catalyzation, and there's the same phase transition if you vary K. The main difference is that in the ordered regime, instead of getting state cycles that are square root n, you get steady states and alternative steady states for the network. Then as you approach the phase transition, you begin to bifurcate off limit cycle oscillations, but then begin to look like they're actually chaotic attractors when you cross the phase transition, in the technical sense for continuous differential equations of chaos, in terms of positive Lyapunov exponents on the attractor. And that tells us that this class of networks and the ordered behavior generalizes from Boolean networks to continuous networks. And I should say just another word for a moment about what happens if things are asynchronous. If you make the networks asynchronous, so you pick at random which gene updates now, then any one state can have more than one successor state. And what you get is the following. In the ordered regime, the frozen component still freezes, and you get something that looks like a wobbly kind of quasi-fluffy orbit, sort of in the vicinity of where the state cycle was. Nobody has worked very much on the asynchronous case, so we don't really know what it looks like. And it's really important to figure out what the appropriate descriptors are for the asynchronous network. And that comes back to your point, Lewis, okay? Okay. But what you still get for the asynchronous network is the frozen component, and we just need, you know, nobody knows the answer. Anyway, coming back to what we found is the following. This is the data for 3 input networks. I have the data for 4 input networks. I don't have the data for 5 input networks, but I'll tell it to you. For 3 input networks, if you make all 256 Boolean functions, you can just ask, how many of you have no canalizing inputs, how many of you have 1 canalizing input, how many of you have 2 canalizing inputs, and how many of you have 3 canalizing inputs? And you get the distribution shown by sort of the lighter gray bars in this bar graph. Now, if you look at the regulated genes, and I was in the midst of telling you the worries, here's the second worry. In order to write down the Boolean function, the experimentalist had to have control of all 2 to the k input states. I believe that for 3 input genes. I don't believe it for 5 input genes and 6 input genes and 7 input genes. Nevertheless, Steve Harris was doing his best to write down a Boolean function. So I got some worries for 5 input genes and more that you don't have control of that. But for 3 input genes and I think 4 input genes, it's okay. And it's here, 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 and here. So the excess of in the observed genes, and we're right down at the level of transcription. We're actually looking at genes turning on and turning off the level of being transcribed, is that there is a great excess of genes that are controlled by 3 canalizing inputs. And you don't even need to do the statistics to believe that this is significantly different, but it clearly is. And I'll show you the statistics on something else in a moment. For 4 input genes, if you pick the genes at random, I mean, if you pick the Boolean function at random, then 96% of them have no canalizing inputs. A small fraction of about 4% have 1 canalizing inputs, and then tiny, tiny fractions have 2, 3, or 4 inputs. And the darker bars are what we observed here, here, way above, and here, way above. And that's strongly statistically significant. So, and the data for 5 inputs looks almost like the data for 4 inputs, just that it's out at 5. In fact, there's just another sort of low number at 4 and then a slightly higher number at 5. But we also looked at whether or not genes show a bias towards high P in the observed genes. And they do. There's an observed bias towards high P. Now, high P, the high P class of Boolean functions overlaps the canalizing class of Boolean functions, but they're not identical to one another. Because if I made a Boolean function that had a 1 and a 1 at the top and the bottom and all the rest are zeros, it'd be high P, but it wouldn't be canalizing. So it's easy to prove. Okay, so here's what we did to analyze that. And this is the thing that I find, in a way, the most encouraging about this. We asked the following question. If you condition on P and ask, is there a residual bias towards high canalizing functions? The answer is yes. If you condition on canalizing and ask, is there a residual bias towards high P? The answer is no. I'm just summarizing the graph that I'm about to show you. The way we conditioned is as follows. Think of all of the Boolean functions of 3 inputs. The possible values, so look down at this graph right here. The possible values of P are 4 over 8, 5 over 8, 6 over 8, and 7 over 8. So pick all of the Boolean functions that have 4 zeros and 4 ones in their response columns, and look and ask how many of them have 0 canalizing inputs, how many of them have 1 canalizing inputs, and that's what's given by these numbers here, the fractions up here, the decimals up here. If you have 5 over 8 in your Boolean function, then here's the distribution, 57% and 43%. And then below each of these, we have the comparison with the actual data, and you'll see that there's 1 over 1 here, and 1 over 1 here, and 4 over 4 out here, and this doesn't matter because there's only one possibility. So we asked for each row in this case, we asked what's the probability that you would get a shift from what you'd expect if they were drawn at random from this distribution of 91% and 8%. And we've got a shift to the right, a shift towards higher numbers, and the probability was 0.004, the probability is 0.001, and the probability is 0.12. So not every row is significant by itself, but they're all showing right shifts, and some of the rows are significant by themselves. If you ask what's the probability that you'd have all right shifts, we didn't do the analysis, but presumably it's significant. Now if you look conditioning on canalizing, you'll see that there's a shift to the left, there's a shift to the left, and so there's no residual bias of a shift to the right. And the same thing is true if you look at the K4 genes, except that for obscure reasons, the order in which these graphs are presented is wrong, is reversed, so P is on top. Notice that when you condition on P and look at the canalizing functions, there's a right shift, a right shift, a right shift, a right shift, and a right shift, and all but this one are significant by themselves, and they're all right shifts. So you could ask whether or not you'd expect to have all right shifts. And if you canalize on, if you condition on C, there's no shift and there's a left shift and so on. So we draw, and the same thing's true for the K5 data. I just don't have it here to show to you. So we draw the following conclusion with one more caveat. So this is the biological caveat. It may be the case that genes that have canalizing functions have genetic effects that are more readily apparent than genes that don't have canalizing effects. And so there's a bias in the observed literature because people have been studying canalizing genes. We'll only know the answer to that ultimately when we study randomly chosen transcription units and find out what the control rules are for them. But we just can't know that. So now I've told you all the caveats. With all those caveats, genes appear to be regulated by canalizing functions. Now, the question is why, and is there any evidence for selection? And I'm going to tell you both a why, and then I'm going to show you that there's evidence for selection. Okay. Why is chemical simplicity? I mean, think of an enzyme that has what's called an allosteric site, so that if effector A binds to the enzyme, it turns it on, and if effector B binds to the allosteric site, it turns the enzyme on. And if they're both present, whoever gets there first turns it on. So that's the OR function. How would you make something that did exclusive OR? It would have to say, if A's there, turn on, if B's there, turn on, but if they're both there, don't turn on. So you see that you need A and B to interact with one another in some funny way, or you need two sites, two allosteric sites, and they have to talk to one another in some complicated way. So chemical simplicity just gives you canalizing functions, I think. I think that that's an argument in favor of why they're around. Oh, I do have the five input case, but I'm not going to show it to you. It just shows the same thing. So what does that imply about Boolean nets? So what we did is we made networks with 65,000 genes, and we biased them to have exactly the distribution of canalizing inputs, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to K, that we observed. Here's what would happen for random networks, and here's what happens for our networks with the observed biases. And you notice that these curves all nearly fall on top of one another. I find that sort of astonishing. Now, I don't really believe that they actually fall exactly on top of one another, but they're at least close to one another. Now, that suggests selection to me. I mean, I don't see why they should be sitting right on top of one another otherwise. So I think what's going on is that evolution's been an opportunist. It's easy to make canalizing functions. Canalizing functions put you in the ordered regime, and then you tune the amount of canalization you've got so you're where you want to be in the ordered regime. Okay, so I can finish in just a couple minutes. I'll burn out your retina. Okay, in the chaotic regime, the size distribution of avalanches are the following. You have a power law distribution of small avalanches and then a peak of huge avalanches. I know of no data that supports the idea that you get thousands of genes that change their activity if you perturb the activity of single genes. I mean, the kinds of data that you get is that if you change the activity of a single gene, at least at the protein level, you change the activities of 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, 150, 200 other proteins, but not thousands of proteins. Numerically, here's the size distribution of avalanches as a function of N, the size of the network, suggesting that it's a power law distribution with a finite cutoff, and that the finite cutoff of scaling is crudely a square root function of the size of the network. So we ought to be able to predict the sizes of the largest avalanches. If we've got 30,000 genes and there's about 170 or so, ought to be the largest number of genes that change their activity, and that's testable. We ought to get a power law, and it ought to show that distribution. The next thing I want to show you is something about the stability properties of these state cycles and the fact that there's a neighborhood relationship to the state cycles. And this gets to the one-wayness of differentiation, Lewis. So here's a network that happened to have 30 state cycles. And what I did is I considered all possible one Hamming unit perturbations to all of the states on one state cycle. So for each state length n, there are n one Hamming unit perturbations. Then if there's 10 states on the state cycle, there's 10 times n one unit Hamming perturbations. Okay, so I've looked at the one Hamming unit annulus around a state cycle and asked how often do you come back to the same state cycle and how often do you go elsewhere. What you see is the main diagonal is filled with big numbers, so most often you come back to the same state cycle. So we've got homeostasis for free. It's just a generic property of these networks that after most perturbations you come back to the same attractor. That's good. When I have a beer, I don't want my liver turning into my spleen. Okay. But the other thing that you see here is that if you go away, this is mostly an empty matrix. It's a sparse matrix. So from each state cycle, you can only get to a few other state cycles. And that means something very interesting. It means that you're going to have pathways of differentiation. If differentiation is going from one state cycle to another, then from this way, from this cell type, I can only get to a few neighboring cell types. And from then, I can get to a few other neighboring cell types. And from then, I can get to a few other neighboring cell types. So you have to have pathways of differentiation. Now, it is true of all multicelled organisms that there are branching pathways of differentiation. Even in the humble sponge, which has the property that if you take all of the cells in a sponge and disaggregate them, even kill them, and then put them in a centrifuge, they will reaggregate into a sponge and looks like a sponge. So the sponge could have made itself by having a zygote that made a big blob of cell types that then differentiated in all possible directions at once, that then reorganized itself into a sponge. But the sponge, too, has branching pathways of differentiation. And this allows me to ask a question that I think is a terribly important one. Do you think that the branching pathways of differentiation in multicellular organisms is a triumph of selection, or is it something that is so deeply inherent in genetic regulatory networks that selection stuck with it? In other words, is it a self-organizing property of complex networks, and selection just has to use it because that's how the world works? I think the latter. Okay, so that means something terribly important that Lewis will cavil with me about. Means that there are two sources of order in biology, not one. Biologists act as if selection is the only source of order in biology. You physicists know lots of examples of self-organization. I'm showing you another example of self-organization, and it suggests, therefore, that self-organization and selection are two sources of order in evolution. And how the two interact with one another is a complete mystery. The more you think about it, the more complex it gets. I'm going to end by showing you something that looks a lot like what I just showed you. Oh, the bottom figure is for each state cycle, the other state cycles that you can get to, the two other state cycles that you get to most frequently. And this gives you the property that if you started here and this was the zygote, you could reach into and eventually get to a bunch of cell types, but you couldn't get back to the zygote. So this gives you a directionality in development, but it also gives you a set of cell types that can change to one another in what's called an ergodic set in a Markov chain. And now I just want to show you that real cells do this. This is work by Jonathan Slack, looking at what are called metaplasias. And this is the last slide I'll show you. This happens in humans. What you sometimes find is that if you look at internal organisms like the lining of your gut, all the way from your mouth down to your esophagus, to your stomach, to whatever, you might find some stomach cells in the midst of your esophagus. It's called Barrett's syndrome. And they're probably precancerous, and it often happens because you get gastric reflux, and that's why Prilosec isn't such a bad idea after all. Okay, but in any case, it's called Barrett's syndrome. So that's called a metaplasia, in which a cell type a normal cell type is in an aberrant location. Okay, and it turns out there's restricted pathways of metaplastic transformations, and they're shown here. None of these are the normal pathways of differentiation of these from the zygote, and you'll see that it looks something like that other graph. The same thing shows up in transdetermination, which you may know about in Drosophila. So this is suggesting the following things. Whatever, of course, these are tissues, they're not cell types, but it's suggesting that there's a neighborhood relationship between whatever cell types and tissue types are. And so again, that's a deep property of networks. And you know, does one believe that selection has operated in such a way that you get a graph like this? Well, I can't imagine why, since they're metaplastic transformations and they're not part of normal development. But it's showing us that, that these different tissues each have only a few things to which they're neighbors out of the whole set. So to summarize what I've told you that there's this class of random Boolean networks and their continuous cousins. The random Boolean networks show an ordered regime and a chaotic regime. There's grounds to think a priori that cells must be in an ordered regime, and that selection has had the ordered regime to work on for 3.8 billion years and to tinker with it and tune it. It's been there as another thing for selection to opportunistically make use of. I mean, why not? It's there. Okay. The same results carry over to continuous networks, so it's not merely the Boolean idealization. If we make this thing non-deterministic by making no clock present and making a stochastic update, then nobody really knows what's happening, but the frozen component still happens. I've told you that the continuous networks show the same phase transitions that the Boolean networks show. Then I've looked at one possible thing that we can actually measure now, and that's whether or not there are biases on the control rules, and it looks like there are. I think with modest confidence we can conclude that real genes are regulated by canalizing functions, and I've told you all the caveats why I've got worries about it, but it's still better than nothing, so I think it's probably pretty good data. And then I've shown you that if you build networks with the observed but caveated biases towards canalizing functions, that they're in the ordered regime and doesn't depend upon K. All the curves are lying right on top of one another. Then I've shown you that such networks fit certain features of ontogeny. So thank you.
Well, you know, I'm totally opposed to everything you
said. Yes.
I really mean it, sorry. As a developmental, but other people, I mean...
I'm not explaining something.
Well, I'm terribly sorry.
He's sulking, that's it.
Oh, dear. Would someone, you know, as chairman, I'm supposed to let other people... Well, sorry, Stuart.
You're not sorry at all, Lewis. I want you to know that the last time we had this argument was in a park in Dublin, and we both had a couple of beers, but go ahead.
Beautifully elegant and unbelievably clever, but it bears no relationship to the way cells behave. And the real point is that if you think about it, if you take two examples, the way cells develop, well, if you take the cell cycle, for example.
Yes.
Yes. If you could explain the cell cycle
right
in terms of this, that would be a very good beginning, and I'll bet you can't.
Well,
because if it ain't like that, the essence of the way cells behave is you go from A to B. It's not a network in which the cells are all interacting one with the other. It just isn't like that.
I didn't say cells.
We get to the system we understand best. That is the early development of the fruit fly, yes? Then I'm afraid it's nothing the way you describe at all. It's A turns on B, which turns on C, which turns on D. There isn't this network about which you talk, which A turns on B and B turns on A and A. You know, if you go back to your little original triangle, that isn't the way cells behave.
But it is the case in the data that Richard Young and all published. Okay, remember. They have a set of 104 or 106 transcription factors. Okay, and they ask, do the transcription factors regulate one another?
Well,
Well, what they've got is 104 arrows.
All right, so it's not scripture.
So that's saying that
it depends on what conditions they do. You can't use both. When you're talking about your billions and you're talking about everything at the same time, I'll bet you £1,000,000 they're not all doing that at the same time. Depends what the sucrose level is, what stage of the cell cycle. It ain't like this.
Here's what we know. Okay. We know from the Young paper that the transcription factors are regulating one another. And
at the same time?
Sure.
That's not the way you did the experiment.
No, but the activity depends on phosphorylation and all kinds
sure.
of
sure.
things.
Sure, but that just makes
sense. The way they did
sure.
look at the bumps they want not what was happening at a particular time.
No, this shows you the connectivity diagram. It doesn't tell you what the dynamics is.
It's a possible connectivity diagram.
It is certainly a possible connectivity diagram.
The connectivity diagram changes with time and the condition which the cell is.
Well, listen, it may change with, as you're saying, Boris, it may change with... It may change with phosphorylation states. For example, if you phosphorylate a protein, you may change whether or not it's able to bind to GIMGAN. But that just says, Boris, let me just respond to that. That just says that you want to enlarge the variables in your network so that you don't just have proteins, you have the phosphorylated states of the proteins, or whatever. You just have a more complicated network.
And all sorts of signals.
Sure, all sorts of signals.
Michelle.
Louis, I think at least some of the genes in the cascade in Drosophila, for example, do interact. I mean, of course, in grape and hedgehog can be.
Of course, there's some interaction.
But of course, there's not total interaction the way it could be described here. There is quite a bit of interaction at various levels, and the levels follow one another. It's true that the levels tend to follow one another at some point, but some of the gene networks get reused later on with the same sort of interaction.
But it's not the real system like this in any way whatsoever.
Let me just state my own major objection, which is that I don't think that actual genetic networks are anything but random. They're not random.
No, I don't think they're random either. No, let me be very clear about why I made random networks. It's the same reason that you physicists, when you're studying spin glasses, numerically, assign the connectivities and the, not the connectivities, but you assign your JIJs randomly out of some distribution. Why do you do that? It's because you want to find out the generic behavior of spin glasses with some particular connectivity properties, and so you just assign it out of some distribution. My making random networks is not to assert that I think that after 3.8 billion years of evolution, real genetic networks are random. I mean, I didn't think that 35 years ago when I started, and I still don't think that. It's to ask whether or not there are ensembles of networks that have generic properties, and whether or not those properties look like they might be useful for selection to act upon. And the answer is that by God, there is such an ensemble. That ensemble is, oh, by the way, if I made a network where I had a Medusa head and then a big tail hanging off of it, which we've now done at my company BIOS for Pioneer Seed Company, you get the same basic behaviors. The genes that are regulated, and it looks like real genetic networks are maybe K is equal to about 1, maybe K is equal to about 1.5. Oh, that's the best data we've got right now. One would expect that such networks would be in the ordered regime unless selection has worked pretty hard to make them not in the ordered regime, because K1 networks lie in the ordered regime, as I showed you with the Derrida plots. Now, can you make networks with a big acyclic graph hanging off of it? In other words, a bunch of genes that are regulated but do no regulating? Of course you can. So we made such things for Pioneer Seed Company, which means that the dynamical behavior of the network is entirely governed by the behavior of the head, this thing with feedback loops and whatever, and the rest of the guys just hang off of it and do what they're told. Okay, so undoubtedly that's what's going on. Now, let me tell you about 4 alternative approaches to understanding what real genetic regulatory networks are. One is to make ensemble models like this, and as we find out more and more and more about real genetic regulatory networks, like biases on canalizing functions, or if we start finding out, as the Young paper suggests, a distribution of specific kind of, quote, small modules, namely regulatory motifs, we can put those biases into the ensemble that we build and have a more refined ensemble. The strength of an ensemble model is it allows you to make all sorts of statistical statements of the kinds that I've made. The weakness is you can never say that gene A regulates gene C, because that's not in the model. So it's got strengths and it's got weaknesses. Second approach is to make detailed dynamical models of little genetic circuits, as has been done for bacteriophage lambda. Weakness of that is that if you try to do it for 10 genes in Drosophila, those genes are being impacted almost certainly by hundreds of other genes, and so how do you understand the dynamical behavior of 10 variables when they're being impacted by 100 other variables? So that's the weakness of that. The third that's going to grow in the future is the following. I use gene chip array data. I make, for example, an analysis of the patterns of gene expressions on different cell types, and I make movies of the patterns of gene expressions as they wax and wane over time as a cell type differentiates. And then we solve the inverse problem, namely, given those patterns of gene expressions, what networks are consistent with that? And I think that that's a growth industry. I also think it's a hard problem. But for Boolean networks, it's only polynomially hard. Okay? For continuous networks, I don't know that anybody's worked on them. And fourth, we can have lots of really good experiments, like the kind that Young's done. So I think we've got this, it's a wonderful problem. I mean, trying to understand how a system of 80,000 or 30,000 genes regulate one another to control development is just a huge, huge, huge problem.
So do you want to make a point?
Well, I just wanted to comment that it seems like the Young data is still the piece, but
what is the Young data?
Young data does deal with
the connectivity diagram, I guess you call
it. Yeah.
It's a quite a different system, a different kind of organism than one like Drosophila, where right, I mean, things happen in a sequential order.
But that's the point.
No,
it's nothing
to do with the environment. The cell's environment.
Yeah, but that's the issue, that Boolean networks, the whole argument was based on the analysis of the dynamics of the network as an autonomous system.
Sure.
Yeast, largely, there is not an autonomous system.
Sure.
All it does, it responds to various environmental conditions and seems to do it by activating small modules of this or that. Right.
Right. So the bacteria.
Right.
Well, if you were to put even a random Boolean network, Boris, into an environment, so you just have inputs coming into some of the genes from an outside thing called the world, okay? Then what you would get is as you changed the world, okay, you would change the basins of attraction and attractors of your dynamical system. Okay. I mean, you can. Just because I made these, in fact, the cells in your body aren't autonomous. The cells are sitting next to one another and they're squirting microhormones at one another too. And so I made models years ago of tissues in which I made cells having inputs from neighboring cells and looked at the effect of all of that. And what, you know, it changes the basins of attraction as a function of their states.
Actually, I want to extend on Boris's comment, and I want to say that even though Young paper emphasizes those little modules, if you look at the data closely, you don't see them really being autonomous from each other. They're very,
correct,
very intertwined.
Right.
And I must say that in confirmation of your point of view, just if you take Young data at face value, the network you get out of it is pretty much indistinguishable from a random network.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. The only thing you have to conserve for each node is the connectivity of outgoing. In other words, for each node, you conserve the number of downstream partners and upstream partners. Then you randomize it, and you get random network, which is pretty much the same as the
other. And you get the distribution of modules that he found?
Modules are somewhat statistically significant, but not out of this world, in other words.
What do you mean by saying that if you randomize, you get something that is the same or almost the same as those? What do you ask? What sense of saying?
Well,
you already fixed the 8th degree and the 8th degree, so
yes.
What else is
that? That is not fixing
so
much, by the way. I'm
okay,
not fixing
so
I'm
going to look at the average distance between nodes and things like that.
Yes, and then you look at those modules and you see, let's say, how many of those simple feed-forward loops you get in a random network and in a real network.
That is what young people do, even though they claim they did it, but that's something.
So that's what you've done, namely, you've taken...
What I've done, and actually Uri Alon in the companion paper, which was published in the same Nature, did it for this network, which he got from me and Kim. And they found that those models are statistically significant, but I guess my message is that it's not that they are so infinitely far from random that you can think about it as a bunch of non-interacting modules. No matter what you get, those modules are very, very interacting with each other and intertwined.
So do you guys these guys have taken stuff enough? Because I really would like to get this before I leave or get... Make sure that
talk to us.
I think this is a good moment to talk about.